Allow me to welcome you heartwarmingly to the 10th lecture of the Deep Reinforcement Learning course. This time we will be talking about something a bit different, but before we get to the current lecture, are there any questions or suggestions or proposals or something? Nobody has some question or something. Nope. Nope. Then let's get straight to it. We talked about these three functions, and it was a bit long and technical on the last lecture. So I've decided to take a break on it a bit. We will continue with thinking about that and coming up with algorithms which will be able to even explore better and better. But now let's just have a small break and talk about quite a different topic. And that quite different topic is the Monte Carlo tree search algorithm and specifically AlphaZero. So let's start with some basics. And the basics, it's an UCB algorithm. The UCB algorithm, it's a shorthand for upper confidence bound. It's an algorithm which allows more fine-grained or more principled exploration than just an epsilon greedy exploration. So when we think about the multi-arm bandits, then what we did is we used the epsilon greedy exploration. So the we used the same epsilon for all the possible actions. However, it seems that this is definitely not the best way to go, because if some action is really terrible and we have seen that it was considerably worse than all the other action, then maybe we should not try performing it so often. So maybe we could have some variable strength of exploration depending on the different actions. That's something what the policy gradient methods did, or hopefully do, because they model the whole distribution and then they can sample from the actions which seem to have a good chance of actually performing well. However, another possibility how to perform exploration in a more effective way is to use something called upper confidence bound. And how does the upper confidence bound work? Well, whenever we are trying to choose the next action, what we will do is we will, let's say that we will consider the Q value estimate. So this is just the multi-arm bandit setting, right? So this is our estimate of the reward for this action. That is the usual thing. But then there is this second bar, which is what makes this upper confidence bound, and this is the some constant times this ratio. Here, this t is the number of times when any action has been taken, and this nt is the number of times when this action was actually a. Right. So if we perform only this one specific action a, then this will be equal to t as well, but usually we don't do it, right? This right side is not really well defined if t is zero or if this number here is zero. So usually you just somehow decide how it will work. Usually we want to perform each action at least once. So often if one of these is zero, then we just try it. So in the first a trials, we just try every action, and then we can actually compute something reasonable. So what the idea behind the update is? Well, the more we perform an action, the better estimate we have, right? So the higher the the number of repeats for a single action, the less this addition is going to be, and that will make us to try and explore some other actions. Right? So there is no explicit non-determinism here. We only choose the action which maximizes these two values. This is our estimate, and then this is actually like our idea of how bad this estimate on this left side actually is. So the more actions we perform, the more we are sure, so the smaller this bound is. On the other hand, when the time increases, then this exploration also increases. So we want to explore more during the course, like we don't want to stop exploring at all. That's why this denominator is still increases, but it increases more and more slowly. This is the UCB just tells you how to choose actions, and then you can just do everything as before. So the motivation is set. We want to perform the exploration only when necessary, only when really we believe that our estimates might be off. So what we will do to arrive at the update, okay, there should be a sum there, and it's not. So there are also some other things missing. So this sometimes happens. So sorry, just let me regenerate the slides so that we can get all the math. So what we will do is we will somehow estimate the probability of our return estimate to be off, and we will use it to tell us which of the actions we should actually perform. Yep. So for that, we will need some theorem which will tell us what is the probability actually of seeing or observing some specific error. So let's say that we have some random variables which are bounded. If they are not bounded by 0, 1, but some other range, it changes the right-hand side. So we can adapt then the equations, but at this point, it seems that they are bounded by 0 to 1, which means the rewards would need to be in this range, which sometimes they are, sometimes they are not. But these are just the constants which will be, in the end, will be hidden inside this C. So if we have these bounded random variables and we compute an average of them, then the Chernoff inequality, or there are set of inequalities, sometimes there are Chernoff, sometimes there are Chernoff opening. I'm always a bit puzzled by it. But what one of these inequalities say is that the probability of the average of the values to differ from the real expectation by more than delta, and this is like an absolute delta, then this probability gets exponentially smaller the larger this delta is. Right? It's generally what these inequalities say, that if we look at the distribution of the sum or mean of random variables, then they tend to have Gaussian distribution. So we can use the PDF of a Gaussian distribution to like get the estimate of what the probabilities of these tails are. So here we are concerned about the one-way error. Let's say that this is like the real expectation. And now we have seen some sample, right? And we want to know what the probability is that it's larger, it's smaller by delta, and this probability goes exponentially fast to zero. If these values will be bounded by different range, then it would change the variance of this distribution, right? The variance of this distribution. However, that's what we are going to use, right? And now what we want to do is We will try to make sure that the probability that our estimate is off by some value goes to zero. Right, so we will make sure that whenever we sample the action, we limit the probability of of an incorrect estimate so that it will converge to zero. And then what we will do is we will choose not just the action by itself, but also this delta value, right? So that's why it's called an upper confidence bound, right? Because we compute not just the expectation, not just the average, but also the upper confidence bound to some value where we hope that the real reward is with some given probability. And we want to make sure that this upper confidence bound gets more and more tight. So the probability that we are not inside this range goes to zero. And by goes to zero, I, for example, use 1 over t to alpha, which means the probability will go to zero with some given strength. Now we can just combine all these together. So if this quantity is less or equal to this one, we will know that exactly what we want to happen is happening, that the probability of a delta difference is limited by this 1 over t to alpha. So when we have such an equality, we can just rearrange, we compute the logarithms and rearrange stuff, and what we'll get is that this delta is at least this value, right? So there is some constant factor. It also includes these things inside, but then here we can see this square root of the logarithm of the number of time steps divided by the number of times we have chosen alpha, our action A. So then in the UCB, we choose the action with the value of QTA plus some constant time this delta. Such an algorithm is actually pretty good. And by pretty good, I mean that it has got an asymptotically optimal regret. We didn't really do much regret all around in this course. And so I'm just mentioning it here on one slide, but I assume you may have seen some proofs about the regret and some other courses as well. So what the regret is, the regret, that's the, like what we could still have improved. Like let's say that we have performed some number of trials. We have observed some return, some number of rewards. In theory, we could have performed the best action all the time, right? So this difference between the n times the return of the best action minus whatever we observe, that's like the I don't know, the pillow, that's like the interval which we can still improve, like in Czech I would say polštář, that we can still get better to. Now it can be shown that the regret of the UCB is actually asymptotically optimal. So up until to constant, it behaves reasonably well throughout the time. So the proof is not going to be here, but there is a link to the paper if you are interested in seeing it. So to also see some practical results, these are just the multi-unbandeds. There is this average reward here, and with the epsilon greedy estimate, you can see that we are improving, but with the UCB, we are actually improving far further or faster. Once again, there is hyperparameter which we need to tune. There's always a hyperparameter which we need to tune, but it seems reasonably well. Although this is once again the performance of various algorithms on the multi-unbandeds, and there are various hyperparameters so that we can see the sensitivity of the algorithms. Right, so this red one is the epsilon greedy, and this is the epsilon, and that's the Monte Carlo epsilon greedy. So yeah, well, it does somehow. If we use optimistic initialization and fixed learning rate. We can get here the gradient bandit, that's an analog of a policy gradient method, and the UCB lives here. So for the wide range of C's, it is actually better than all the previous algorithms. So in a sense, being asymptotically optimal might not mean enough, but in this case, it's not only asymptotically optimal, it really tends to work very well in practice. However, as we defined it independent on states, right? We just computed this number of times where some action was taken, and specifically this one. But generally, it's not straightforward to expand this somehow to a full MDP. However, we will be able to actually use it in the Monte Carlo research. So, some questions? Doesn't seem so. So, let's get to alpha zero. 2 years ago, actually 2 years ago, there was a very interesting paper which described an alpha zero, which is system which demonstrate that it can learn chess, shogi, and go, like three quite complex board games. In the so-called tabula rasa settings, as the English say, we don't have some specific, I would say, Czech phrase for that. But it means that it was able to learn these games without any prior knowledge, really just out of the blue and without incorporating any human biases inside. So this alpha zero system was a continuation of the several systems before. For originally there was AlphaGo, and then there was AlphaGo Zero. And there are actually several versions of this AlphaGo, because there is AlphaGo Fanhui and Lee Sedol and AlphaGo AlphaGo Master. There are a lot of them. But AlphaGo Zero is like the last in this line. And it's the only one which we'll cover in detail. There are also papers describing the previous ones, but I would say that it doesn't make much sense in developing into them, because like these generalizations made the results actually better. So the result of the algorithms were quite impressive because they were able to really beat the whatever best, I would say best human, but humans are no longer better in any of these games for quite some time. So they were evaluated with against the strongest programs available. Usually for all many of these games, there are some tournaments between also the machine contestants. So the winners of these have been used. And you can see the results here. For example, here you can see that the percentage of wins when AlphaGo starts, that's the green portion, and starts mean it is white, right? Compared to the Stockfish, that's the other best program, or other, that was the best program, and the winner of the 2017 championship, I think. The interesting thing is that even if AlphaGo doesn't start first, if it's black, it still wins more often than losing. And like this 30% win ratio, that's really a lot, right? I don't know if you play chess, but many of the games tend to end in draws, because that's how it is. If nobody does a big mistake, then it's not so easy to win. With shogi, this is really dominating results. And with Go, the best actually available system was AlphaGo Zero, like AG Zero. But you can see that the Alpha Zero was actually able to win even against that, independently on whether it is beginning or not. Yep. So how does the system work? Generally, the alpha zero uses a neural network, which, given the state, and the state is a position on a board, predicts two things. One is the vector of move probability. So that's like the policy of what actions do we want to take in order to win. And it also computes the expected outcome of the game. And the expected outcome is in the range from minus 1 to 1, where 1 means we will win, right? Minus 1 means we will lose. And if there is a draw, then usually it's defined as 0, but only if there is a draw. Now, the most interesting part of the AlphaZero is the Monte Carlo tree search. So usually when you implement some board game, you use probably some alpha beta search algorithm, which like tries to go through all the possible combinations in the game, and using some pruning, like if you can see that you can never do worse in this or you can never improve in some specific subtree, then it doesn't make sense to go through it anymore. But generally the tree search, the alpha beta tree search, is like exponential with the depth of the tree, and it just enumerates all the possibilities to make sure that it really is able to produce the best results for the given depth. So instead of that, we'll use the Monte Carlo tree search. The Monte Carlo tree search can be seen as like a powerful policy evaluation operator, right? It gets network which predicts the policy and the value estimate, and using a lot of simulations it produces a better policy and a better value estimate for some given state, right? So we give it the policy and the value estimation at the beginning. We give it a neural network which is actually able to compute these for any other states as well, and the Monte Carlo tree search will like evaluate the policy and get us a better estimate of the predicted outcome and a better estimate of the distributions of the actions which we should take in order to maximize the return. Usually, or for all these three board games, we will use zero returns until the last step. And in the moment we get to the terminal state, the reward and also the return is either plus one or minus one or zero. Yep. So we have this policy evaluation operator, the Monte Carlo tree search, and what we will do is we will play or perform a large sequence of your simulated self-playing games. So we will be playing against each other, against ourselves, and from a very large sequence of these simulated self-plays, we will try to come up with the best possible with the best possible strategy with possible agent. Yep. So I said that we will perform these self-play games. So in order to actually do them, we like start in some initial state, right? When we need to perform a move. So in order to perform a move, we will use this Monte Carlo tree search, which gets the neural network and gives us, among others, the policy. And we will choose a move depending on the policy, or somehow according to the policy, and we will get to the another state, right? Then we will perform another Monte Carlo tree search in that state. We will once again get the distribution of the actions. We choose an action according to it, and we will get into another state, and we will repeat this until we'll get to the final state. Right. Once we get to the final state, we will score the game either as won, lost, or a draw. I didn't say it explicitly, but we actually assume that we have the model of the environment available, right? So this is going to be a model-based algorithm. So what we assume we can do is we can assume that we can enumerate the valid actions in a given state. We can actually perform them. So whenever we perform the actions, we get the next state, and we can also tell for a like finished game what the reward is, or even the return is in the final state, right? So we assume we have this. We also assume that these are deterministic because that's how it is for all these three games. Definitely. Yes. Exactly. That's, in a sense, that's the great thing of the model, right? The models, the other research models which we have, they usually don't do it like through the, when we do, when you do the research, you don't get to the bottom, you get to the terminal state. Instead, you have some kind of a heuristic which will allow you to like do the research, right? So you like search for some number of time, and then you can use some heuristic information which will like somehow tell you whether this position is a good or a bad thing, right? For chess, the heuristics can be composed reasonably well, and they kind of make sense. So even machines like Deep Blue 20 years or even more than 20 years ago were able to surpass human performance. However, all these heuristics contain some kind of a bias, right? It might be a good bias, but it might be a bad bias. So maybe a position for which the heuristics is good is actually not that great, because the position, like the figures themselves or the pieces themselves, are not in a great situations. And ideally, want this to be captured by the heuristic, but it's just the heuristics, right? So in the reinforcement learning settings, we don't need something like that. We just simulate all the games until the end, and the only way how we can get a reward is to simulate the whole game. So it will probably be difficult to optimize, but if we are able to optimize using such a reward, then we will just ignore our behavior during the game. We don't mind losing pieces if we win in the end. Yeah. So this is how we will run the self-play games. And now, when we have a game which is being played until the end, then we will use it to train the neural network. And we will train the neural network by minimizing the error between the predicted outcome and the simulated outcome, right? When we have a game, and we have won or lost, then we consider all these board positions to be either won or lost, depending on this whole game went, right? So then we can train the network, our model F, for each of these positions. I don't know, for example, for this one, to predict the outcome V as this simulated outcome set, and predict the policy P as the policy pi generated from the Monte Carlo research, right? So we use the Monte Carlo research to improve our policy, and we use the simulation until the end of the game to give us the estimate for the result of the game. Also, usually the L2 regularization is used as a part of the loss, especially because all these games use some deep convolutional head to get the representation of the initial state. Yeah, so we have the mean square error between the predicted values. We have the cross entropy, okay, divergence for the action distribution, where this is the one written by the network, and this is the one simulated by the Monte Carlo research, and this is the two regularization. So Monte Carlo research, right? That's the most interesting part. So how does it look? In the Monte Carlo research, we will be building a tree. The tree begins with some initial state, with the state where the Monte Carlo tree search is being executed on. And then there will be nodes for states. And like each edge means there is some action A, which will get from this state S to this child state, right? Some of these actions, some of these states will be leaves, while some of them will still have more children. Yep, so that's what I just said, but just drawn. And now for each state action pair, we will store the following statistics. It doesn't, at this point, it doesn't really matter if you store these in the parent or if you store them in the child, where this S state action pair leads to. It's not that important, but the important thing is that we store it for this SNA pair. So what we store is the visit count. So how many times we actually visited or performed this action A from this state S during this Monte Carlo tree search. Right, then we have a total action value, so that's the sum of all the values which we have seen from the simulations which included this state and action pair, and we use these two values to estimate or to compute the mean action value. So for the given state and action, our estimate of return is just the ratio of these two values, right? Usually we don't store this explicitly, instead we store explicitly the visit count and the sum, but in the formulas we'll be using Q, and whenever we need to complete the Q, we can just get it. And then we also have the prior probability of selecting the action A in S, right? So these Q estimates, that's something what we have seen in the reinforcement learning all the time, and we estimated for one Monte Carlo tree search by counting and observing some estimation, the return estimates, and then we'll have some prior probability, right? We didn't really have this for the other or settings in the MDP, but we will have it here. And now the most magical part, or one of the most magical parts, is how to choose actions. And we will choose actions by using like a version of this UCB algorithm. The UCB is upper confidence bound. Now there are several algorithms which are called UCT or PUCB or PUCT. This tree is tree, right? So UCT is like upper confidence bound for trees, and this P stands for prior. What we are going to do to choose an action is to follow the following expression. Some action in time t will be chosen so that it maximizes the sum of these two values. This is the current estimate of the return, like with the state action value estimate. And then this is the like upper confidence part, but it looks a bit differently than it looks in the UCB algorithm. So there is some constant here, but it can depend on S, right? So we had this C times the square root of logarithm of time divided by NTA. That's what we had in UCB. Right, so there is a constant, but it can be state dependent. Then there is this prior distribution. So we have some prior of wanting to perform this action A in this given state S, right? So that's this P in the name of the algorithm. And then this is some estimate of the upper confidence bound, which looks quite different than it was looking in the UCB. And in the original terminology, this would be the square root of T divided by 1 plus NTA. right? So in the original formulation, it looks like this. This CS, that's the constant. Now the constant is actually not that much constant. It is it increases slightly with time. So that's like the exploration rate, some constant initial value, and the logarithm where we have the number of times we have visited the state S. So the more we visit the state S, the higher we are slightly increasing this constant, not just here, but also inside this C. Yep, I didn't maybe say it explicitly. The NSA is the number of state times we have visited the state action, and NS is just the marginalization, so it's the number of times we have visited the state S. The paper uses 1.25 for the initial exploration constant, and then this hugely insanely large constant C base, 19,652, which is like the base of this logarithm, right, in a sense. Well, so this is like the logarithm with C base of this value. This like logarithm of this is zero. So this is slightly larger than zero, but it grows extremely slow. It grows logarithmically with this constant. So these constants are just being used in the algorithm. I think it's the alpha go zero, the one which these constants come from. And there are no actually supporting experiments or some evidence why these were chosen. They were just chosen. Also, it's not obvious until this moment why do the authors use this form of this UCT formula, because normally you would expect this to be the logarithm of this NS divided by the logarithm of everything divided by NSA, right? That's what the UCT should look like, or that's how it is derived, and that's all the proofs work for. In the paper, they just say, oh, we use this slight version of the PUCT formula, and they reference a paper which actually uses this one, right? So people have wondered. There are some people which are implementing the open source version of this, and there are like 10 of issues, like why does it look like this? Can we do better? Like, can we come up with the best, better constant? So generally it doesn't seem we can do much better. People have tried a lot of different versions, and for some reason, this seems to work well empirically. So that's probably also the way how the people from DeepMind got to this content, because they maybe tried some of them and then just evaluated like which of them works. But as far as I know, and I've tried to search this here as well, there is no reason or no known reason why this is a good estimate. Like in a sense, it has similar properties, right? It increases with time. And it decreases with the number of actions which you perform in the specific state. But that's it. There was a student on the course 2 years ago, who was from the mathematical department, and he said that there is some nice reason. The nice reason was something like, so I will just try to say it, and maybe you can think about it, and maybe you can come up with also some theories. But the theory was that if we use this specific formula, then if we sample, then like if we would ignore this part and sample just using this formula, then the resulting samples would like honor this distribution. So if we started with some distribution and sample using this, then we should get something similar to the original prior. Seems like a good property to have, because we are using this as a policy evaluation. So I'm not really sure if this holds, but that's, I think this was their view on why this would be a good formula. So I'm just passing it further to you without any more supporting evidence. In any way, what this does, it tells us how we choose the action, and it combines a lot of values. First, the Q value estimate. So whether we think that we will win or not, right? Then the second part, which tells us like how good do we think the action actually is a priori, and also some idea, some estimate of how off can our Q estimate be. All right, so the more experiments we get, the larger this parts go. But if we perform enough experiments, we can also make it smaller. But this is multiplied by the prior probability. So if one of the actions is extremely, extremely good, then it may happen that the prior for it will be stronger than the rest of the exploration constant, and we will just always use that one specific action in the given state. So this is how we choose actions. Some questions, ideas, or are your heads exploding or something? They have already exploded. Okay, so during the Monte Carlo research, we need to make sure that we explore enough. When you look at this, then if we have some idea, some strong preferences about the priors, then we never let go, right? If all of these are zero apart from one, which is one, then only this action is going to be here. And that means that we will like tend to choose the action a lot, right? This is nearly one. This is also a large value. So it can really easily happen that we will sample like nearly just one action most of the time. However, that's not good if you want to perform like an exploration, right? Of course, so this tries to do some exploration, but what we will do is we will add or toss in additional exploration, but only in the root state. So when we start the Monte Carlo research, what we want to do is we want to decide with which action we want to actually perform. So during this evaluation, what we do is we like deliberately try also some, let's say, random actions. They will not be that much like uniform or something, but we will try also some random actions so that we are not overlooking anything, right? So once we are inside the tree search, we just believe that our priors and the tree search will be enough. But when we consider the responses, like in the first level, we will include the additional exploration. This additional exploration uses like combines the priors plus the noise sampled from a Dirichlet distribution. So 25% goes from Dirichlet, right? And the rest comes from the prior. And this actually just influences the prior, but it makes sure that like even actions which have extremely low prior have a good chance of getting non-zero value and have a good chance of being sampled. Yep, so this 25% is being used all the time, but the size or the strength of the hyperparameter, the pseudo count for the Dirichlet distribution varies across the games, mostly because of the number of actions, I would say. So I don't know how well versed you are with the Dirichlet distribution. The Dirichlet distribution with the concentration one, like this is just a uniform distribution. And the Redekind distribution is the distribution over distributions. Like it gives probability to probability distributions among k classes. So sampling from the Dirichlet distribution means sampling a distribution. And if this alpha would be one, then it would be a sampling the uniform distributions on k samples. However, with this parameter being smaller than one, we will sample distributions which are not uniform, but instead they have a higher probability on a smaller number of actions. The thing is, in many of these games, there are like hundreds of actions, even thousands for some of them. So if you use the thousands of actions and use some uniform noise, then every action will get like nearly zero, right? Because there is so many of them. So instead, this Dirichlet prior makes sure that some smaller number of actions get some non-trivial boost, right? So I don't know, you can imagine that 10 of the actions get higher increase and the rest of the actions are not that great. And that's only true for the, generally, this is true only when this alpha is actually more than zero. But by the way, the Dirichlet distribution, that's one way how to describe it, is the limit of this like ball choosing scheme, right? When you have got a bowl of balls of different colors, then you just throw one and then you put it back and you put back another ball of the same color. So when you do this very often, then if you do this like infinitely, then the distribution where it will converge is what the Dirichlet gives you. So for the same alphas, the resulting distribution is still uniform, but the variances are quite large for the alpha being smaller than one. So this is what will cause these imbalances in the samples actually. And we'll need also to sample from the Dirichlet distribution. So in order to do it, what you can do is you can sample from the gamma distribution and then compute the average or the means or normalize the resulting samples so that they sum to one. Yeah, this should be changed. I'm just writing down to fix this. So I will talk more about this exploration, but it's an important part of the algorithm. Anyway, what we already know is we have the tree search. So we have the tree, we have states, it can look like this. In each state and action pair, we have got this number of visits, observed, estimated returns, the Q value being computed from it, and the prior. We know how to choose actions. We know that in the root, we also add additional exploration noise. So during one tree search, we start with in the node and we choose the actions until we get to a leaf node, right? So until we are, have chosen an action and we have never chosen this state action pair until now. When this happens, then this one simulation is over, but we will expand the tree. So what we will do is we will add a new node to the tree, right? The one where this state and action goes. And we do a sequence of steps. First, we evaluate the new state by the network, which means we will get the priors and the estimated value function for that state, right? Then we will create its children. So for all the possible actions from this state, we will create its children. We will initialize their visit counts to zero. we will use the prior from computed by the network, right, as their prior probability. And now we will also update the estimates in this in these upper parts of the tree. So what we have done is we have like simulated one more move, and that has gotten us an estimate of whether we will actually win the game or lose the game, right? And what we will do is we will update the value estimates on this whole path, right? So for this state, we have seen another outcome which started with this state, right? So what we do is we increase the visit counts of all the parents by one, and we increase the estimated return by V, right? So this V gets to be added everywhere. Yep. Of course, usually between these states, the players switch side. So actually, like when we add this V at this point, we usually need to swap it around, right? To revert it so that like if we won at this point, it means we lost this one, and that it means we won and lost, right? So it's a bit simplified here on the slides, but we need to do this, of course, correctly. Yep. So now, yeah, there should be an image here, but it was maybe a bit too big, and if the images are too big, they are not drawn. So let me get to it here. Yep. So this comes from the Alpha Go Zero paper, and it shows how the whole Monte Carlo research works. So first we select the path through the tree until we find a leaf. So until we get off the tree and we see a new state. At that point, we expand the node. So we create a new node in the tree. We add all its children and we evaluate it. So we get the value function, we get the estimate of the return, and we get the priors. We store the priors in the children and use this V to estimate to update the estimates of the Q function of all our parents. And this we do for some large number of times, which allows us to return the new distribution of actions and the new estimate of the root node. And then we can use that to actually perform an action. Right. So I will make sure that the PDF slides do contain the image. Now, for a single tree, so for a single state, we usually run several hundreds of simulations. And what we then need to do is we need to return the value estimate and the policy or the distribution over the action. So the distribution of the actions is proportional to the visit counts of the children of the root node, optionally exponentiated using some temperature T. But as far as I know, in all the papers, apart from some ablation experiments, this temperature is always one. So after we have finished the Monte Carlo research, we actually look at how often or how much time we spend in these states, and use these as the distribution of the action. So whenever we went often, that we think is actually a good move, right? We also return the Q value estimate. Well, we just update this V value in this node. So it's just the average of all the outcomes which we have seen until now during the simulation. So once the Monte Carlo research finishes. It will give us the distribution and we need to actually act on it, so we need to play. We will consider two possibilities of how we can behave. Either we will choose, like we will use a stochastic policy, and this stochastic policy will be just this pi, which is proportional to the visit counts. Or we could play deterministically by choosing whatever action gives the best, highest probability in the return distribution, so the one which we visited the most. So this is like what we could do. And when we generate the self-play games, then we use this stochastic policy for the first 30 moves, while we use the deterministic one for the rest. Right, so when we are performing, yep. So the idea is that in the end, we need to get this Z, this final observed return of the this one, right? That's why I'm going here. And we need this to be to reasonably apply to the whole sequence, to the whole states, to whatever happened in the beginning of the game. So what we do is at some point, we always perform the best available action, right? So that we get the like estimate with the least variance, because like doing whatever best we can seems like a good idea. I'm not saying that we do this inside the Monte Carlo simulation. We still run a lot of simulations in every state, but once these simulations end, we just choose the node which was the most likely. However, the most frequently visited. In the beginning of the game, in the first 30 moves, we also consider some variability in the play so that we also encounter some non-trivial states, right? So something actually happens and we don't always follow this one path, but like to get the wide range of different states, then we consider this stochastic policy at the beginning. Yep. There is a visualization of, yes, definitely. Yes, well, the question is what the result should be, because what we estimate are these Q values, right? So maybe this could be used, or this P could be used, but in a sense, they are both utilized when the action is being selected, right? What we compute is like the number of times an action has visited, has won this like tournament, and this estimate of Q is actually being used there. The prior is also being hidden there, right? So the number of visits is actually the number of times this action seemed to be the best possible choice. So it's a bit weird, but that's how it works. And from this point, if this argument is true, that this would sample the actions with the prior policy, if nothing else was here, then this would be a good behavior, because it means that if we started with some prior and didn't get any other information, we would just visit the counts with the same prior and we would not change the distribution of the outcome, which might be a good thing. So if some action is a good one, it has got a high Q value estimate, so we will sample it often. If some action has a high prior, we will probably sample it often, voila. We also have this Dirichlet noise on the route. So we will actually also consider some additional actions which are don't have neither a good Q value estimate or a prior, but we will just try to visit them some number of times. If they seem terrible, if their Q value estimate will go down, then we will probably not sample them often. But if the model seems that they are not bad, then it will also like simulate them and think about how well they are actually doing. And this will allow the resulting policy to also have some exploration noise, right? And that's one of the reasons probably we are doing it just in the root node, because then it directly translates into the target policy pi, right? Because it's generated using this prior including this noising. So there is a simulation or a visualization of Monte Carlo tree search in one specific chess position. This is after 100 simulations, and the numbers inside are the Q value estimates scaled so that they are from 0 to 100. Right. The actions are really the moves. So we can move a figure, and the size of the node, or the thickness of the border of the node, is the visit count, right? So at the beginning we have visited a lot of states, and all the time we see 10 most visited states. Right? So at the beginning we are exploring like in a wide-like manner. We don't have much Q value estimates, right, at this point, so they don't influence the sampling too much. If we sample something which is less than average, then the Q will be even below zero. So at the beginning we will probably sample quite a lot different actions, but after higher and higher number of simulations, this is after 1,000 of simulations, we will start concentrating on the most prominent actions, because their Q value goes high, the exploration rate gets smaller and smaller during the number of trainings. So we can see that the more simulations we do, the more deterministic the search actually seems to be. Of course, it doesn't just look like this. There are many other nodes here. Each simulation actually creates a new node, unless we get to the terminal state. So this tree would contain a million of nodes, but we only show the 10 most visited ones. Yep. And we really just take the distribution over these actions to be the resulting distribution. So this was the Monte Carlo tree search. There are various things in here, and the most interesting thing is the exploration. Like generally, we assume that the opponent will just do the best thing, and in the simulations we frequently assume that he will just do whatever is best. So it's possible that during this Monte Carlo tree search only some part of the search space will be actually searched, right? Because you say okay, so I'm doing the best things, he's doing the best moves, and that's it. So if the opponent does something like stupid, it's something which maybe doesn't have a high probability of winning, then that's a move which you don't really consider during these searches. And it might happen that your model will not actually be able to react on it reasonably well. Like, it's one of the issues I see with this algorithm, is that it concentrates on the moves which make sense from point of both of these players, but it doesn't. It might happen that for the moves which are not very great, the model will not actually know whether they are good or bad. So if you, I don't know, train from the starting position, and then you just take some random position and try to see what the model will do for it, then it depends whether this position was encountered or not during these simulations. And if not, then it may happen that the model will not have a good idea of what to do. Well, maybe it will, because it will generalize from the other positions, but maybe it won't. So if you, for example, want to be able to explore, react to the wide range of states it kind of makes sense to also reflect this during the exploration, right? So maybe if you are interested in seeing the estimates for some, I don't know, 1,000 frequent openings, then it makes sense to use these openings during the simulation to make sure that all these states which you care about will be actually visited, used during this Monte Carlo research. Other than that, the Monte Carlo just tries to win, but when it considers the prior policy a lot, it can happen that it will not concentrate on some of these states too much. Well, all this is mostly like my ramble. Generally, it seems it works quite well. First, we have this this noise prior, right? So in every position, we also consider actions which may not seem good, but we still do them, right? So it may they may still happen, especially in these first 30 moves. Right, so this is one of the reasons what made the games to be varied, to be different from another, so that we actually seen a lot of different states. And also we have the neural networks, which luckily generalize very well. So even if some specific state wasn't really visited, then there is a good chance that some similar one was, and that the network will decide actually correctly. Nevertheless, let's get to the network. For these three games, very similar architecture was used. First, the history of eight board positions was utilized, and all these games, they just use a two-dimensional grid. So the input board is usually represented by some n times n planes, some number of them, and they indicate various informations. That's the input. The output is the categorical distribution of possible moves. So we are computing the softmax across all the possible actions which we can do. For Go, that's simple. In Go, I don't know if you know Go, but in Go, you add a new piece each time you play. So you choose a free spot and you just add a piece of your color to it. So choosing an action just means choosing a place and then placing a new piece there. However, for chess and shogi, you need to move a piece to some different position. So how does it work? Well, for each position on the chessboard, for example, you consider all possible moves. So there are 56 queen moves. Then there are the knight ones, right? And there are also the so-called under promotions. If you are very nearly on the top, if you have got, I'm sorry, you have got a pawn here, and you are moving either here or here or here, then normally when you get to that place, you will get a queen, right? But you might also decide to change this piece into a different figure. So you might choose either a rook or a bishop or a knight. So these nine under promotions are three different positions where to go, and three different figures to pieces to change into apart from the queen, right? So that's quite a lot of moves, 64 squares times all this. So that's really something like 5,000 actions, quite a lot of them. So the input or the whole network is quite a deep convolutional neural network. So we start by, generally we use 256 channels and 3x3 kernels. We batch normalize the networks and use rectified linear unit activations. We also use the residual blocks in the like non-bottleneck version. So we have got 2 3x3 convolutions with the rectified linear units. And then we have the residual connection around them, and I'll never know whether the ReLU is here or it's after joining whatever they used in the paper. And then there is the two heads, the policy head, which generates the policy. For the games where we need to move specific pieces, we add the convolution policy head with as many filters as possible moves for each position. And for Go, we just add a linear layer of some fixed size. So there is just a fully connected dense layer on the output. And there's also a value head, which uses the first CNN of one times one kernel one. So we like get one value for each position. And then we follow this by another rectified linear unit. So we get just one number, then a fully connected layer, and then the final layer of size one. We need to bound the size, the output in the minus one range, which we do by using the tunnel activation function. So this is what the network looks like. Here are the inputs described explicitly. So for example, in Go, we have two features, each with like one bit of information. And one of these, they describe the stones of one player, and the other describe the stones of the second player. And we also add the color information, like which means whether we are P1 or we are P2. So in total, it's 17. Why it's 17? Well, these are the features which are repeated for the 8 historical positions. So it's like current situation before. So it's 16 channels here, and one channel which is the color of the player who is going to play now. For chess, we have got the positions here. We have different planes, so it's like we one hot encode the pieces. So we have the bishops, rooks, queens, kings, knights, and then just the pawns, right? So six of them. The same for the second player. And the repetition, there are rules, like if you will repeat the same position, I don't know, three times or something, then the game will end in a draw. So in order to understand that it's happening, there is explicit information here. And there are some number of like, which color do we want to do? How many of moves have been performed? Whether there already was a castling, or maybe whether it's possible still to castle for these players, and whether like nothing happened for some number of time, and these are reasonable for actually understanding whether there is going to be draw or not. These constant informations, they are still fed to like all places, right? So if this color is just one number, we will anyway change it into a plane of 8x8 and use this information in each position, right? So it will be a new channel, like a constant value channel of the whole input. And then this is the same for Shogi, but I don't know how it works, so I cannot explain it to you. But generally, the input is like 17 channels for Go, more than 100 for chess, and more than 300 for Shogi. So these are the outputs, which we already talked about. The Monte Carlo research, the network, and the training. Now we will want to train the network. So we will need data, and then the training process. So to generate the data, we will just use the self-play games of the network with itself. In the previous iterations of Alpha, Go 0, they used different opponents, or maybe the best performing opponents, and so on and so on. But with Alpha 0, they just use the current version of myself, of itself, to play against. Each Monte Carlo research uses 800 simulations before a next step is actually being performed. So during the training, we keep a replay buffer of 1 million most recent games. And during training, what we do is we sample from this replay buffer. So the replay buffer is, in a sense, like two-dimensional, because it contains some number of games. So what we do is we sample uniformly, I think, from the games, and then in each game we sample uniformly for all the visited boards, right? And when we visit this specific state, then we use the simulated outcome as the value target for the neural network in this position, and we use this computed distribution pi over the actions. So that's the one which is proportional to the visit count in this situation. So we'll use that as the target for the policy of the network. The batches have enormous size of quite large size of 4,000 game positions. So SGD with momentum is being used. And during training, the training was using 16 the TPU V2s, so the whole pod with V2 TPUs, and the self play generating the positions. That's actually the more the expensive part of the training, and uses the 5,000 first generation TPUs to like generate the games in parallel. So each TPU gets the current weights from the master, and then it uses these weights to generate the whole game. Then it sends the game to the replay buffer of the master. It gets the current version of parameters, and then it simulates another game. And for each step, it uses 800 simulations, which means we will go through the tree, and whenever we visit a node which we haven't, we'll do the expansion. So there are 800 evaluations of the neural network for a single state in the game, and the game takes hundreds of moves or something, so we really need to do like tens of thousands of simulations in order to just see the result, observe the result of one game. However, with this massive artillery, we can train the chess shogi and go in 9 hours, 12 hours and 13 days. Now, this 9 hours of training in chess was able to actually really be, come up with the best chess agent so far. In all cases, we train for 700,000 batches, each with 4,000 positions, right? So in total, we are talking about 3-4 gigabytes of states, right? Something like this, maybe three. And these states were sampled from 44 million games. So for each game we sampled, so 100, something less, so something like 80 games for a single game. And the thinking time of running these 800 simulations is something like 40 milliseconds. So this happened after 3 hours of training or something. For Shogi, takes some time, and for Go the training is the slowest because simulating one game takes the longest. But you can see that even in AlphaGo, the original AlphaGo it was from the 2015 or 16 was very frequent or was like lost very soon in the beginning of the training, and this green one is the previous AlphaGo Zero, and this blue one is the current one. So interesting observations. First is that authors say that the training is highly repeatable. So once you have set all these weird constants and PUCT rules and all the things, then once you do it, then the training works. So it's not like that you will see a success in 1% of the cases. Once you have things correctly, you will just really, you should see the training to progress reasonably well. Note that for AlphaGo, the current version of AlphaZero doesn't use symmetries in any way. However, the original AlphaGo Zero did. Because in Go you can take the board and rotate it, or you can mirror it, and nothing will change. The position is still the same. This doesn't work for chess or shogi because the positions are in a sense absolute, right? You just cannot just swap the board by 90% and then just think that it's still the same one. It's not, because the absolute positions matter. So the AlphaZero doesn't have it, and they probably wanted to see how well it will go for Go as well. So here are some ablation experiments which show how we would improve if we would use the symmetries. So if we would use the symmetries, there are two possible ways how to use them. First, during training. So whenever we train for a given board, we might perform a random symmetry on it. And also we could do it during the Monte Carlo research evaluation. And if you do it in both places, you can train your agent much faster. So this is the original AlphaGo Zero. This green one, that's the AlphaZero without the symmetry. So that's why it takes so long to train. When you look at the number of update steps, it's not that different. But the difference is that you need more time to generate the data, right? Because in the AlphaGo Zero, what it did is that it added you can imagine that it added the mirrored reflected representations to the replay buffer. So it didn't need to wait for so long to generate enough data to train on. But when symmetries are not used, we need to simulate for much longer. These simulation results, they are better, meaning that if you use it, you have got data which are less correlated than if you just use the rotations. So when you look at the number of steps which you perform, you will see that the convergence is faster. But when you look at the number of times you actually need to get these data, it's much slower, right? So if we include symmetries, it would train in a matter of 2 days and not 13 days or something, which the normal does. You can see the training is slightly less efficient in the number of steps, but that pays off by requiring less hardware to do the simulations. So what's interesting is that during inference, AlphaZero utilizes sees or explores much less positions than the existing agent. So for example, Stockfish is like a super implemented version of alpha beta pruning. So it sees, I don't know, like a million of positions when it decides whether you want to move or not. But in AlphaZero, what they do is they actually perform only like thousands of evaluations. The thing is, the evaluation is much more costly than computing the heuristics in Stockfish, for example, but it is much better. And it also generates these priors, which are then used to guide the Monte Carlo tree search, which is like the important thing. So from let's try to go through the tree, which the regular planning does, we have much more expensive function, which can nevertheless navigate the tree much more efficiently, right? So it's like a trade-off between what number of experiments do we do and how well are we trying to perform these single step. There are some ablations where they try to use some smaller number of time in chess, and you can see that until like even with 1/10 of the thinking time of Stockfish, it's still better. When only 1/30 of the time is given to AlphaGo compared to Shogi, then it's already worse. The interesting thing is that by default the Stockfish didn't get an opening book. So the idea was that it should play in this tabula rasa setting, but of course people are wondering what if it does get the opening book. So if it gets the opening book, the alpha zero still wins, but by a smaller margin, right? So these are comparable numbers. Funnily, it wins more often with the opening books than without. In any ways, you can see that the performance of the Stockfish improves. So the AlphaGo doesn't win as much when it starts, but still, it's better. Human openings mean that we start from positions encountered by humans. So this is connected to what I said, like whether this exploration worked reasonably, and we can, like, as defined, it would be fine if the agent was able to win just from the initial starting state, right? Some of these human openings might not be visited frequently, and maybe the program will not work that well. But if you look at the result, actually the converse is true. So the existing agents do worse when they need to start with some human opening than the neural network. So probably either the exploration is efficient or the generalization of the neural networks is responsible for improving the performance when starting from the unexpected state. These are the ablations of the neural network architectures. These come actually from the Alpha Go Zero, so from the previous paper. What they do is they compare two things. First, the residual connections and the convolutions, right? So the rest uses this, the residual connections around them. And then whether we want to have shared or independent representation for the value function and for the policy. So dual means we have one convolutional feature extractor and then two heads. And set means it's separate. So we have separate convolutions at the beginning, one for the value function and one for the policy. So this step is what we have been doing most of the time in the assignments. And this is like the shared one. Generally, what happens is what you would expect. So using residual connections is very important. And sharing the architecture is also an important thing. So here is the LO rating. So this is the like using independent neural networks without residual connection is the first. Then adding like sharing, it's better, nearly to the degree of having residual connection, and combining both of them still improves, right? Here is the prediction accuracy of the professional moves. The interesting thing is that, for example, this dual resolution has lower accuracy in predicting the professional games while it has higher rating. So in a sense, it seems doing whatever the professions do will not give you the best possible behavior. But if you look not at the moves, but at the outcomes of the professional games, then this is no longer true. And even like the best network, like, can, like, even if the test version cannot predict the actions with the highest accuracy, it can predict the probability of the outcome with the highest accuracy. For the people who play chess, there is a study in the paper which shows which positions does the algorithm actually prefer. So the great thing about this tabula rasa setting is that when humans play chess, they play in a supervised way at the beginning, definitely, by explaining to them which of the moves are good ones, like getting some intuition from the existing players. And this is built up on the like hundreds or thousands of years of experience in a given game. But it can easily happen that there are some biases there, which we just don't know about because we haven't seen games without them, right? So training the games just out of the blue, out of nothing, without any original knowledge is a great thing because it allows you to explore whether like this is true or not, right? Because like this is like the artificial intelligence in its prime, right? Because like just from the set of rules, we can come up with the rules. From the set of rules, we can come up with an agent, which just can do something completely different than whatever like the common knowledge would be. So yes, definitely. So I am unfortunately not a good chess player, I would say that I don't know. What I remember from the paper is that this, open Spanish, or which I don't know which one is the, like the famous opening. Is it Spanish? I think it's Spanish, right? Open Spanish. Then in the end, it was like discovered during the training. It's probably this one, right? The one which is like very common. But then, so it discovered it as a good strategy, but then it decided that it's not actually worth much and started to concentrate mostly on some other one. So in the end, tends to use something which is less frequently used in the professional games, but it's difficult to say whether like how different that actually is. In the Go game, I'm also not a good Go player, so just take it with a huge amount of salt. But what I get a feeling that like if you have a Go board, it's like an extremely large 19 by 19, right? So in order to actually like handle this large space, what people can do is like they in a sense can like learn good patterns which works locally, right? So they when they look at some small places of the board, they kind of understand what's happening there. Like it's one of the theories is that they actually like have the visual cortex being able to find the patterns which really work or not. And so also the Go players sometimes just look at the board and they say, okay, so I think this is a good position. I don't know why, right? It seems like these shapes are either good or bad, but I'm not really sure. But this works locally. Of course, people try to use some global strategy, but what people usually cannot do is to see like how a minor change here in one stone will influence all the behavior in the rest of the board. However, the trained agents don't seem to have this kind of limitation, right? So they usually are able to consider the individual stones in the full context of the overall game, right? So that seems to be like good thing that they don't like follow the basic rules because they always decide the move in context of the whole board, while people to keep this large space manageable do the decisions sometimes just based on some like local surroundings. I'm not saying that people just look at 3x3 and then decide, but it seemed that this is one of the interesting capabilities what these agents have. So they can behave differently depending on quite large or like quite distant context. Other questions, ideas? So in the AlphaGo Zero, originally they actually used the supervised position. So in the first AlphaGo, the supervised learning was important, and they started by training from the games and then just use the reinforcement learning to improve the results, right? But then there was this AlphaGo Zero, and the zero means zero experience. So like once they have implemented this, they probably trained or like tried to do it without the experience. It to big surprise, actually was able to train just by playing a lot of games, 44 million against each other. So in a sense, it really is magical that 44 million games is a lot, but the number of combinations of different positions is also a very high number. So in a sense, this is an efficient way of exploring the space, even if it still cannot be trained on your machine overnight or something. However, we have this hardware which is capable of training this in 9 hours. Well, that's really super. So it's already 4 minutes past the time, so I don't want to keep you to keep you here longer than necessary. So thank you for your attention, and we will see each other on the practicals on Wednesday. What we will do on Wednesday is that we will have our last competition assignment. It will be a competition assignment. It will be Monte Carlo research implementation, of course. And because it's a competition one, it will have a fixed deadline in the first week of January, right? The rest of the assignments is already none of the competition is postponed until the end of the semester, but this one is not, because I want to do the evaluation. So that's also the reason why we are actually having this lecture today, because which is a bit unrelated to the previous ones, but I wanted to have as much time for the assignment as possible. Okay, so I got carried away, I'm sorry. So thank you for your attention, and we will see each other on the Wednesday practicals. And if you have still some further questions or are wondering about something, then please don't hesitate to ask me even now. I will still be here, but if you are going, bye-bye. Thanks.